Welcome to the Free to Lead podcast, journeys of leaders, driven by passion, inspired by purpose. My name is Will Steele. I'm the host of the show. I'm a transformational business and leadership coach. I say transform the business owner, you transform the business. So if you want to be the fullest version of yourself in the world, decisive, taking clear action, moving forward, producing the kind of results and having the kind of impact you really want to have in your business, in your life, and in the world, then stay tuned. The people on this show that we interview are handpicked. They've got pearls of wisdom. They're going to share their breakdowns, breakthroughs, their challenges, what they've dealt with, how they've grown, and how they've become free to lead. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, I'd love to hear from you, and I'll be telling you how you can get in contact in about 20 minutes' time. Right now, let's dive into today's episode. Welcome to today's episode of Free to Lead, Journeys of Leaders, driven by passion, inspired by purpose. I'm joined today by Dennis Meader. He's a pioneer in legal marketing, over 25 years of experience. He's passionate about revolutionizing how attorneys, or lawyers if you're in the UK, connect with their ideal clients. And he's developed a legal podcast network, which is groundbreaking. And the platform transforms lawyers into local thought leaders through strategic podcasting. He's helped countless law firms amplify their authority and attract high-value cases and cultivate lasting client relationships. So without further ado, Dennis, welcome to Free to Lead.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. And it's not an everyday business most people can get into, law, right? Unless you're a lawyer yourself. How did you end up in that? If you give us a little bit of a backstory of,
sure.
I believe you've been in business quite a while.
Yeah, I've been working with attorneys since early 2000, so it's a little over 20 years. And I got into business-to-business sales, virtual sales, in the late 90s. I was in college, started selling advertising, tried face-to-face. I didn't mind it, made good money, but I preferred, hey, I can talk to 30 business owners in one day, sell four or five of them, and move on to the next day. I don't have to travel all over the world and show up to places and have them, oh, sorry, they went to lunch. They won't be back for a few hours. Can you reschedule? All that stuff that happens when you show up at places. Yeah. So I really liked selling in a virtual environment, which in the yesteryear meant calling them on the phone. Then as time has progressed, I went from the phone to now primarily Zoom or something like that, Zoom or Google Meet or whatever. Early 2000s, I had a partnership from a company that I had helped start that kind of disintegrated. And so what enabled us, or somebody recruited me into the legal industry, and I had been selling ads, $300 here, $400, $500, nickels and dimes. But when you save your nickels and dimes, they add up to dollars and 20s, right? So I'd been selling in that sort of format. And then I got recruited, and they were like, oh yeah, our program is $5,000 a month for personal injury attorneys. And I was like, who spends $5,000 a month on marketing? Like, to me, like, I just didn't even realize that was a thing. So I got into it. I did well. And what more than just doing well, I liked working with attorneys. I like not having to use sales tactics, because attorneys are very well versed in sales tactics. So if you use sales tactics on them, they spot them right away. They call you out on them. If you, oh, what would happen if I could bring you five new clients this month? How would that change your life to have an extra $25,000, an extra $300,000 in your practice this year? What would that mean for you? That sort of old, I feel, it's a slimy sales tactic. But you're selling something that doesn't exist. And yeah, you're selling an idea. I just didn't like that. What I liked about attorneys is I could say, hey, here's my program. Here's how it works. Here's some of the results we've seen. Here's what we might anticipate for you, but can't guarantee. What questions do you have? What about this? It works like this. Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Have you considered this? And you can use logic, and you can, the thing about attorneys is they don't mind arguing. They do it for a living. So you can have a discussion back and forth, and then they'll admit, they'll be like, you know what? You're right. Let's give it a try. And that's what I liked about him, is I like being able to work in the place of logic as opposed to manipulative emotion in selling people. And so that's why I've kind of stuck in the white collar and primarily attorney fay or niche almost for over 20 years now, for the most part.
Fantastic. And if you look at that, then what is it that you're proud of? Because you're definitely full of passion. You can hear it.
What am I proud of, like right now or in general? Or
if you look back.
I would say what I'm proud of is the amount of people that I have met through my career that I've been able to mentor and take 20-something-year-old kids that were making 30, 40 grand, and now I know probably 15 to 20 people in different markets that I've been in that are all making 250, 350. And that came from me just taking them under my wing, teaching them the mind frame of a successful long-term salesperson, teaching them how to think, teaching them how to approach. And so I would say the thing I am most proud of are the people that I have invested in. And even though some of them, they're off living their life, we might be in contact every 3 years. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. I can look at that and I can say, you know what? Yes, it was them because they had the intelligence and the acumen to get there, but I had the ability to recognize it in them and help them cultivate it. And then they had the hunger to follow what I taught them and see that. I have somebody right now in my own company, started off as a SDR, making a few hundred dollars a week. Now here he is, less than a year later, he's making a few thousand dollars a week. And the first 6 months, I didn't do a lot of, well, when they say this, you say this type of stuff. I just said, okay, think about what just happened there. Think about what they're trying to get across. Now think about how you responded, and just like teaching him those, like the granular thought process behind what goes into sales more than just the tactics behind it.
Great. Oh, awesome. Awesome. And if you look back, you told me before we started recording that you started business at 14. Can you say a bit about how did you get into business?
Yeah, so it was an accidental thing. In a way, I started fending for myself at about 8 years old, me and my little sister. My parents got divorced. My mom went off the rails a little bit, and we lived with her. So our house was a party house, drugs, alcohol, drive-by shootings, gangs, just crazy stuff for about 5 years of my life. And I learned very quickly that if I didn't take care of me and my sister, my mom was just like, she was barely taking care of herself at the time. Mm. And I started noticing every night we'd have a huge pile of beer cans sitting in the kitchen, in the sink, on the counters, and then just a huge pile. So we'd dump them out, rinse them out. Where we lived, you could get 5 cents for each can. So there was a deposit. So we would go in each morning I'd usually hold 4 or 6 big trash bags full of cans. My sister would take one or two. And we would go up to the gas station or the grocery store and we'd cash in all of our cans and we'd get 10, 12, 15 bucks, depending on. So if you do that times 20, 10 bucks at 20, that's 200 cans sitting every night at your house. Think about that. 200 to 300 beer cans sitting there from partying. Wow. So we would go in, we had 30, 40, 50 people at our house until 3, 4 in the morning every night. It was just not a healthy situation for a kid. But what it taught me, and I don't want to focus on the negative, what it taught me was there's ways to make money all around you without you even realizing it.
Yeah.
And from that, finally, my dad got remarried and he settled down. He got back into church and his new bride had a couple of kids that were a couple years younger than me. And so I moved in with them at 13. And I had a buddy that told me, hey, if we go and shovel snow, we can make $100 in a day. So I go to my brother and I'm like, hey, dude, let's go shovel walks and we'll make money. And then his best friend wanted to come along. We go, it's cold, there's heavy 8 inches of snow on the ground. We're going about an hour into it. We're cold. We've shoveled 2 walks. We've all got $15, $10, something, not a whole lot of money to show for our work, in our opinion. At that age, right? And we come to the next, and we were taking turns knocking on doors. Then we come to the next door, and it's my brother's turn. He's, I don't want to knock on the door. We'd done 2 jobs. Both of those jobs, I got the job. Then his friends, I don't want to do it either. So I was like, I'll do it. I just tried, but I'll try another one. So I go up, I knock on the door. The older ladies, yeah, sure. Do this and this for $20. She hand me a 10 and 2 fives. And I was like, I could shovel this walk and we can keep doing what we're doing and wait 30 minutes in between each job. Or I went down and handed my brother $5. I handed his friend $5. I said, shovel the walk down to here and shovel the sidewalk like this. You guys each make $5. I'm going to walk ahead and I'm going to keep knocking on doors. So by the time you're finished, you'll be able to start the next job. So that's what we did is I knocked on doors, got the job. They came, knocked on doors. They came and I got it to where I was stacking 2-3 jobs down the street. Then I would start backwards to help them catch up. But for the most part, they did all the work. And what I learned was you make a lot more money making things happen than actually doing them. Yes. And all of those people, I went back, I wrote down their name, their address, what job we did and how much we paid. And I would knock back and I would come back and I'd say, hey, it snowed. We're here to do the job. $20, blah, blah, blah. And they'd be like, just assume the sale, 14. I'd just come back. I'd assume the sale. We got a whole route with my brother and his friends. Then the spring came. It was lawn mowing time. Just did the same thing. Knocked on doors, arranged the job. They got half the money. I got half the money. Then fall came and went and the beginning of winter, I got all the paper routes within a walking distance and I resold them and I did all the collection. I was the face and my brother, who was 11, 12, 13, him and his friends, they would all do all the work. And I'd go out on a Saturday, spend about 3-4 hours, collect all my money, go give them all their pay, put the other half in my pocket, go play basketball, buy Jordans, do what I needed to do. And that was my first business.
Yes. Yes. You woke up to something there. Did you tell them that you got half or did they not know that?
Oh, they knew that. They knew that. Oh. And anybody that would ever complain about it, I'd say, if you want to get your own customers and you want to knock on the doors, and I'll tell you, I knock on about 12 doors for every client I get. And so are you willing to have 11 people slam the door, ignore you, dogs bark at you? If that's what you want to do, that's fine. You go get your own routes. But they all liked it because they just showed up and worked. They didn't have to do the hard part of talking to adults and getting the jobs.
Fantastic. Love that story. That's great. Awesome, awesome, awesome. If you look back, have you had any big failures that you were big at the time, but now you can look back and see a lesson in that?
That's every failure. But I would say my biggest failure in life has been choosing partners. I have had two businesses that I've, one where I invented the product. We came in as 50-50 partners. I invented the product. I wrote all the sales scripts. I trained all the core sales staff. And within 1 year, we were doing $3 to $4 million with a net 25% profit, selling some ads over the phone. So then I was like, hey, like we don't both need to be here day to day. How about you run the day to day? I'll run things from afar, look at reports. And then I actually ended up traveling. I lived in Romania half the time. I would call back and run the business from there. And we got about 3-4 years into it. And then he just decided, you know what? He suggested that I open up a new office in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was between Tulsa and Knoxville, Tennessee. Those were the demographics that made sense. College educated, a little bit higher unemployment rate for high college education. So they were good job markets. So I get there and I open up this office. I've got about 15, 20 people working for me, including my sister, my brother-in-law, my cousin, like people that have moved in from like across the country to work for me. All of a sudden one Friday, and I was using my residuals from the first company. All of a sudden one Friday, I look at my bank account and there's no deposit. So I call him and I'm like, hey dude, where's my deposit? He's, oh yeah, my attorney told me now you're competing and you've broken our non-compete clause. I was like, first of all, you suggested I open this office. Second of all, we share a website. Third of all, we split the states evenly on paper in a contract. Fourth of all, I invented the product and trained all of your people in your office. So I got a lawyer. His lawyer said, bankrupt the company and reopen it in your wife's name. So he bankrupted it, reopened it in his wife's name. Now he went from a 25% net to a 50% net because he had to send a thing to all the clients. Hey, sorry, I can't fulfill. And he had a backup of clients. Hey, we're closing. You don't get your product. Sorry for your luck type of thing. So now he's getting a 50% net profit. He decides that's his new business model. So every 9 to 12 months, he would bankrupt and reopen. About 2-3 years later, and if I'm going to tell the whole story here. So if that's okay. Oh. 2-3 years later, I'm back. This is my hometown. I've moved on. He's back in my hometown, a place called the Quad Cities in Bettendorf and Davenport, Iowa, Rock Island, Moline, Illinois, right on the Mississippi River, south and west of Chicago, about 3 hours away, to just kind of contextualize it for people out there. So I'm driving past, and we have a 7,000 square foot office, 40 something employees. So I literally said it to myself, I could kill that man. Like, literally, I was so angry because I saw he had a Mercedes and a big Tahoe, and he had ripped me off for literally multiplied hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably a couple million by that point, because I was making $350 as just a residual income off of that. So if you multiply that by 2-3 years, that's quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what? I've always told myself, I refuse to be bitter. No matter what happens to me in life, heartbreak, heartache, I might separate myself from people to protect my heart, but I'm not going to be bitter towards them. I've seen what bitterness does to people. So I pull into the parking lot. I park. I walk in the front door. The receptionist knows exactly who I am. She hits, Al, Dennis is here. So I go upstairs. I sit down in his office. We're sitting across from each other. And I look at him and I say, I don't even know if you think that you need this or that you've done anything wrong, but I want you to know that I forgive you for what you did for me, because I can't live like this being angry and bitter. So I forgive you. He then breaks down and he says, ever since I did what I did to you, my life has been ruined. My son is in jail for life for a drive-by shooting. I cheated on my wife and got caught, lost my marriage, just thing after thing. And then he literally said, I will sign over the whole business to you. I knew what he had been doing. He'd been ripping off customers every year. I knew that this was going to catch up to him. There's no way I was going to tie myself back up into that business. So I said to him, I was like, I'm not really interested in that. We can have a friendship, not like best friends like we used to be. Because this guy started in a 6x8 office, taking turns calling. We took that, living from getting a credit card, waiting for it to process so that we could pay a bill, going from that to $3-5 million a year with 25%, but for him, 50% net profit. So like life had changed so much, but he was just bawling. And I just said, listen, I'm not interested. So I had that ripoff. But what did I learn? I learned, one, my dad said to me, are you sure you want to go into business with this guy? He just doesn't seem right. And I chalked it up to, oh, dad, you're just old school. You're prejudiced because this guy's a black guy. And you think just because he's black, he's going to rip me off because you're old. That was that's what my brain told me. And the reason he did what he did has nothing to do with his race. It has to do with who he is as an individual and his own personal moral compass. And then the same thing that launched this network, I came in a partnership with a guy. He had less than 80 clients doing less than $1 million a year. I said, I'm going to come in. I'm going to grow your business. We're going to do this. And then in 5 years, we're going to renegotiate because I'm going to show you how much. But until then, I'll make X amount of dollars. I took the business in 5 years from less than $1 million to $4-5 million, from less than 100 clients to over 300 clients. Developed the sales process, brought in the sales team, trained everybody, had about 15 people underneath me that I brought in and grew his company. Comes time to renegotiate, and he's hired all these people in his ear. You don't need that guy. You don't need that guy. You don't need that guy. So he uses the buyout option, which was based off of 5 years ago at $1 million. So pennies on the dollar, what I should be getting.
Yes.
And buys me out. And then just washes his hands of me. And I'm like, okay, if you guys like, so now guess what? With this business, no partner. I think I've learned that it's better to be the primary owner, never be in a secondary position.
Yeah.
And that was the biggest lesson that I've learned. But I think the more important lesson for me was you are going to get hurt by people, but that doesn't mean you give up on people. And I think that to be able to come back from a couple of instances like that, where people that I cried with, laughed with, spent countless hours with, planning, building, thought we were building a life together. And one big lesson I've learned in business, everybody is very like giving, and they're very like, oh yeah, oh no, that'll, if you do that, until you start making money. And then the moment success comes, everybody starts grabbing for more pieces of the pie and they start fighting. When there's no money, everybody gets along well.
Yes.
But when there's money coming into the business and it's a difference between making $350 this year and $500 this year, and if you can just rip this person off or tweak this, like, that's just the way that it is. So I understand that now. And when it comes to business, when I have an individual that I'm working with, I'm just like, listen, at the end of the day, he might like me, but I'm not more important than him, than his or her money. Because his or her money, to them, that represents how they take care of themselves, their family, their future. So I am never more important than somebody's money. And I remind myself in that in the way I work with my employees and in the way if I have any partnerships in that regards as well. Long answer, short question, but there you go.
Yeah, a lot of history there. And we go through those. I'm sure there are entrepreneurs, business owners resonating with some of that, myself included. Having business partners can be very tricky. Yeah, I can.
If half of marriages end in divorce, and a business partner is probably closer than marriage outside of physical intimacy, but emotional intimacy, because like I love my wife, but I can't like I talk business to her and she's just her eyes glaze over and she's just, okay, honey. But when you have that person that you're like, yeah, then we could do this and we've got that and we're going to go here and they're just like, yeah, like you just have this person. It's like, you think they're right beside you and you think that together you're going to conquer the world. And not every partnership is a bad business partnership. Maybe my weakness is that I'm too trusting. I always see the best in things. And so because of that, choosing partners for me probably isn't the wisest thing.
That would be if you were working with me, I could see that as something to transform, because there are, as you said, there are business partnerships that can really work also.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Wanted to. What happens when something happens? We make decisions. We make stuff up. We can't help it. And we'll find evidence for it as well. We'll see, there you go. And before you know it, that's reality for you. So it closes you down in whatever area it is. In this case, having business partners. I'm not sure if you want another business partner. You don't need to have a business partner, but sometimes it works, right? And it can work. You definitely want to cover it.
Yeah, what I've tried to do this time is cultivate directors over each of my different divisions and work very closely with them and create an atmosphere of honesty and openness in our meetings. We have a weekly 2-hour meeting with my directors.
Yep.
And if I can tell they're holding back on something, or if I say something and I'm like, guys, give me some counterpoints. What doesn't make sense here to you? What don't you like about this? Like, I don't need an echo chamber of my own greatness. Like, I'm an entrepreneur. I already have enough self-confidence. Like, because entrepreneurs, like, there's something wrong in our head that we just get up and we're like, hello, world, let me conquer you today. So I don't need echo chambers of awesomeness about myself. What I need are people that are strong enough to say, what about this? And I don't really like it because of this. And so then it forces me to look at things from a different perspective. And so that's how I'm trying to tackle that problem, is create. I've got 3 people over 3 different divisions. And then as I talk to them and say, okay, I'm thinking about this and this for within your realm. What are the pluses? What are the minuses? What don't you like? What do you like? And if I have somebody, but they're always just, oh, that's great. I already know. I can't cultivate them for leadership.
No.
Because a leader has to be able to stand on their own 2 feet and stand up for what they believe in.
Very good. Very good. A leader sees what needs to be done and says something about it. They don't let it go. Don't just walk over it. Very great. There's a lot of lessons there for people listening in, or really good. It's not really feedback, but it's really good to have that there, you know, as a reference. Oh, okay. I remember this guy saying this about that. It's like, you could say, be very cautious about who you choose as a partner.
Mm-hmm.
Also cover yourself so that you've got it all down legally, the rules, of the engagement.
Think about, again, the comparison of marriage versus a business partnership. In a marriage, you're going to date that person for months or years, depending on how intense the relationship is. Like my wife, we met and we've been together since our first date. Like literally we knew right off. It was just boom. From literally the first date, we talked about if we're going to have kids. We talked about how we want to live life. We boom. she went home, like, that was on a Monday night date. It was just like a last minute at a pop-up at a brewery. Monday night. Thursday night, she goes home. Friday night, she comes back. She brings her dog with her, a couple of suitcases, and she kept her apartment for 4 or 5 months, but she literally was with me from day one.
Great.
So you think about how, but we didn't get married for almost 2 years later, right? But yet we'll meet somebody and we'll be like, oh, wow, you're really good at this and this. We should look at partnering up, and we'll have one lunch with them.
Yeah.
And we'll draw stuff out, and then we'll be like, yeah, I think this will work. And then we slide it across the table and we're ready to have a partner. I think we should have, like you talked about, a better vetting process if we're going to partner up with somebody in business than just a few words, a lunch or two, and now we're gonna work side by side to try to make something out of nothing.
Yeah, I can totally resonate with that. I went into business in a totally different business as a, as a creative idea, and the guy turned out in his history, which I didn't check, we didn't check, he'd been liquidated 3 times, his business. Yeah. So he was just in it for the ride to get see what he could get out of it. And a very amicable person, very believable and all of that stuff. But I got caught and I learned a big lesson. Don't walk over anything. Don't walk over any little thing because it bites you in the ass later.
It does.
All right, great. Coming back to what your business is, can you just say it's attorneys and on the getting them connected to clients that suit what they really want to be working on?
Sure. It's called the Legal Podcast Network. And what we do is essentially we use podcasting as a way to just create a multitude of content because we are in an earned media age. You can no longer hide behind logos as a business. People want to see founder-led or C-suite-led marketing. They want to identify with who they're going to work with. That's just the way that it is, especially in the B2B realm, which is what we're in. What we do is we will do a podcast with an attorney. We onboard them. Who's their ideal client profile? What is their jurisdictional profile? What is what we call their brand profile, which is really, are they calm? Are they high energy? Are they like, just so that we can gauge the show according to them? Is it more of a serene, like kind of calm person? So we build that out. We build a content plan and we do just like a 20-minute FAQs where we create the content plan. I have a content director who's been interviewing attorneys for over 10 years, done over 1,000 interviews for attorneys for content purposes, for website content, for books, things like that. So she's just amazing. So she gets together their whole content process based on their ideal client profile. And each session, we'll ask them about 7 to 10 questions, depending on how fast they answer. It's about a 20-minute podcast. We then take that podcast, and they can do one a month. They could do 2 a month, or they could do 4 a month. If they do one of those a month, then every single day they'll have one post on all their social media outlets, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google My Business, all the way up to 10. We can tie them all into one. So every day they get one post, 30 days of posts from a half hour of their time. Plus we create 2 to 3 pages of content, FAQ type content for their website, which helps with SEO search, things like that.
Yep.
If they do it twice a month, then they have 2 full shows go out every day, twice a day. They have 2 pieces of content, shorts and reels, audiograms, static posts. We combine the 3. And then if they do a weekly show 4 times a month, then every day they have 3 pieces of content go out on all of their networks. So morning, noon, and night, which is really what the algorithm wants. 3 pieces is like what the algorithm's really. That's the standard amount. So for half hour, 1 hour, or 2 hours of their time, they could have that much of a content stack where, so it's more than just podcasting, although the podcasting is important. We create videos, we create a YouTube channel, we create shorts with it. Then that YouTube ties into Google. So now when I type in, let's say I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina, and we have a client there and it's a divorce attorney. And I type in what happens to a second home during a divorce. So why would an attorney answer that versus just like attorney near me? That indicates a high asset divorce. That indicates somebody who's thoughtful and really trying to understand the situation that they're in, which means they're not going to buy or engage an attorney based solely off of cost, which is what's really happened with the industry. It's become commoditized. And they're being pre-sold on the authority of this attorney because they check out the podcast and they go to the website, they see the FAQ, maybe they list, watch a couple of videos. So by the time they call this attorney or engage with this attorney, they're 75, 80% sold because they're already seeing them as that expert. Whereas most people, attorney, divorce attorney Charlotte, they just get a list of 100 attorneys. They start calling, what's your rate? And there's really no points of differentiation at that point. So that's really what we're doing is creating a content conduit for our attorneys to showcase their expertise to answer the questions of their very specific ideal clients. So that then will cultivate those clients and bring them further down the purchasing path than a standard Google search call.
Great, great. If there are any attorneys listening to this, how would they reach out to you? How would they contact you, Dennis?
Dennis Metter, DennisMeador. So Dennis Metter on LinkedIn, pretty active there. And then our website, thelegalpodcastnetwork.com. And you can see testimonials. You can see some samples. We have a couple places where you can click. We have a whole section that is nothing but podcasts for attorneys to grow their business. And then we have a section of podcasts of nothing but for people who need attorneys. And we actually, they can pick their state and practice area. And then whoever pops up, it'll say, here's the three attorneys in your state that can help you. This is the one in your market. Then they could go to their podcast, watch a couple or listen to a couple of podcasts. So yeah, we really try to make it super simple, but our website's got everything. My team, which I didn't even really talk about Tracy a little bit, but like our pre-producer, she did a podcast for Stephen King. So the people that we have working on this isn't just like people we found off Fiverr and we're just throwing them work. These are professional people that have done this for 7, 10 plus years.
Yeah. And did they do it virtually or do they have to come to your studio?
Everything's virtual. Our clients are all over the United States. Right. Like I told you, I'm in Belize. I'm in Belize. I live on an island. And then our people that like I have people in Denver, I have people in Florida, I have people in Texas, I have people in Pakistan, I have people in the Philippines, I have people in South Africa. I have about 30 people all across the world that do all of this. We're going to hit 1 year, May 1st. We have about 100 clients and we have about 25 to 30 team members. I lost count. Last time I checked, it was like 26, but we were doing some hiring, but we eliminated some, consolidated some positions. But anyway, long story short, we've got a great team. So go to the team page, check out who it is that you're working with. Because so many of these SaaS type programs, they got this flashy, nice looking site, but then you try to get to somebody. You can't call anybody. You can email them and get a response in 3 days, or you can chat with an AI bot that says, I'm sorry, can you repeat that? We put right at the top, here's customer phone number. Here's new inquiries phone number. Here's customer email. Here's new inquiries email, the top of every page. And then go to our team. You could see all of our people and you could call and be like, hey, can I talk to Tracy? Yeah. Tracy's also works with client success. So we try to be real people that are really accessible, but are using modern tools to help attorneys.
Awesome. Awesome. Great. Great for being on the show. It's obviously you've got passion and you have a purpose in what you're doing. And it is great to have you on the show. Dennis, thanks for being on Free to Lead.
Thanks, Will.
Will Steele here. Thanks so much for listening to the Free to Lead podcast, Journeys of Leaders, driven by passion, inspired by purpose. If you're a successful leader and you're driven by passion and you're inspired by your purpose and you'd love to be a guest on the show, we'd love to have you. Just visit podcast.willsteele.com. That's podcast.willsteele.com. Will Steele is spelled W-I-L-L-S-T-E-E-L, all one word. If you got something out of today's interview and you'd love to share it on your social media, we'd love you to do that. You can take a screenshot on your phone, you can text it to a friend or post it on your socials. And if you know someone you think they'd be a great guest, tag them on social media or just let them know about the show and include the hashtag Free to Lead. I love seeing your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. And to make sure you don't miss any episodes, go ahead and subscribe. Your thumbs up, your ratings, your reviews, and your comments go a long way to help promote the show, and that means a lot to me and my team. If you want to know more, go to our website, willsteel.com, or follow me on LinkedIn under Will Steel, or Facebook under Will Steel, or Instagram under Will Steel Coaching. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.